Hello and welcome to the Roundhouse Podcast. This is Paul Solentrop of Wichita State University Strategic Communications. Today we're going to talk to former Shocker baseball player Mark Grogan about his book called I Owe It All to Baseball. We appreciate you listening. You can rate and review the Roundhouse Podcast wherever you get your podcasts. You can find more Wichita State Athletics content at GoShockers.com. We have Mark Grogan, a former Wichita State baseball player. Mark is from St. Paul, Minnesota. He played infield, looks like mostly second base and third base at Wichita State from 1982 to 85. He twice earned spots on the NCAA All-Regional teams, 83 and 85. A little more background on Mark. He hit 323 as a freshman in 42 games for those Shockers, which ended up as the NCAA runner-up. And 311 is a senior with six home runs. Mark now works and lives in Kansas City. He is here to talk about his book, I Owe It All to Baseball, which includes a collection of his poetry, in addition to stories about growing up as the youngest of nine in a big Catholic family. There's lots of baseball, lots of Shocker stories. Mark, thanks for your time. Why write a book? What did you want to get out there?
Well, Paul, I've written a lot of poems over my life, and a lot of people have told me I needed to publish a poem book. But since everybody had a lot of free time over the coronavirus pandemic, I sat and had a lot of free time to think about my life and how I got to Kansas from Minnesota, and how fortunate I have been to come from, where I came from and where I've landed, and the family that I have now is really a family I didn't have growing up, because my father passed away when I was four. And it's kind of where the book launches, actually. I wanted to talk a little bit about the life that led me to start writing poetry, and also how appreciative I am of where I came from and how many people had to touch my life to give me the life I have now.
Yeah, the death of your father when you were four. How did that event shape your life and being a part of the large family that you write quite a bit about?
Well, I only have two memories of my father. And one was when he was in a wheelchair. He had had a stroke when he was 52 years old, and when he was 54, I heard sirens, and I ran up to the attic. I remember this very well because it's such a embedded memory in me, and I looked out, and he was being rolled out into the ambulance the last time I would ever see him, and he had a heart attack and died at age 54, and I don't want to say I became obsessed, but I think that's probably the word, with baseball, because it was there was a grade school across the street, and I just started throwing balls against that wall. I don't know if it was to isolate myself or just to because I really enjoyed watching the Minnesota Twins, Rod Carew at the time, and things like that. And it was just kind of and I was really fortunate too in my neighborhood growing up. Dave Winfield played for my Legion team, followed by Paul Molitor, which is unbelievable that two of the greatest baseball players of all time were from my neighborhood. And so it was just something that I, just became obsessed with, is the game of baseball. But it was a long way from there to get to Wichita State, obviously.
Yeah, I think that's not uncommon for kids growing up that go through difficulties, that sports becomes a refuge, an escape. Do you think that was the case for you?
I would say that is a true thing. Just kind of, to get my brain off of, the traumatic things. One of the things I always kind of struggled with growing up is, you know, my grade school had what I would call a little bit of a crazy youth program, in that in baseball and football, they had first through sixth graders all playing in the same league. And I was a pretty temperamental little kid. If you remember the shortstop in the movie Bad News Bears, the kid who was kicking the ground all the time and throwing his helmet and everything else, that that was probably me as a little kid. And it's kind of a dangerous thing to have when you're playing against kids that are 80 pounds bigger than you. But at any rate, I fought that all the way, through. But along the way somewhere, people noticed that I had some talent, could look through my temperamental side. So that was one of the things I really am grateful for, is that I had coaches that stuck with me when they had to put up with some behavior that was pretty childish. So,
yeah, you write a lot about your temper. How much of an obstacle was it, and how did you get it under control and deal with it?
Well, one of the stories in there was when I was playing high school basketball, and we lost on a last shot of the game, and the ball bounced to me, and I kicked it, and it was like one of those moments in your life that you're just almost goes into slow motion. You see the ball sailing, and it hit one of our parents in the face, and I'm just like shaking my head, like, oh no, what did I just do? And sure enough, the following morning, I was in the principal's office, and I went to an all boys Catholic military high school called Cretan High School. And at any rate, I really was fearful that I was going to be kicked out of the school. And instead, they basically said, you know, this is your last warning. You need to get that under control, because, you know, we know you're competitive. We know you're trying really hard, but at some point you got to grow up. And that might have been the moment that I had to look in the mirror and say, get it under control. Although I have another story about, you know, my Shocker days that I had to look myself in the mirror another time to get it under control. So that's took me a while. So
a real turning point. You mentioned Cretan High School, which is one of those well-known Catholic schools, cranks out a lot of great athletes. Paul Molitor, Joe Maurer, probably maybe chief among them. Right. How did attending that school influence you?
Well, obviously, there were a lot of retired military people, and the fact that I did not have a father at home for, you know, if you will, disciplinary purposes and things like that, I think that was probably a good thing, that I had a little bit of structure put into me. And I also was really fortunate that I had a high school baseball coach. His name was Dennis Denning, and he had played in AAA for the Orioles and broke his wrist so bad he couldn't go on playing. But he was in the era when the Orioles had, you know, Davey Johnson at second base, Brooks Robinson at third base, Mark Belanger. I mean, so he was really a very good baseball player, but he put me as a starter as a sophomore. And I remember the seniors just absolutely couldn't believe that he was playing me at shortstop, because I was I don't know what I weighed then, probably 140 pounds and scrawny. And he just stuck with me, all the way through my senior year. And, he said at the end of my senior year, when he gave me the most valuable player of the team, you know, I know a lot of people don't like the way he, you know, kicks the ground and pouts and things like that. But I will tell you this, no one on that team wants to win more than Mark. And because of that, when you have, you know, a good player that is also the kid that cares the most and hardest worker, it drives the other players. So it really, that really really meant the world to me that he said that. So
you write about growing up in the Twin Cities, going to Twins games, going to North Star games. Favorite Twins player?
Oh, definitely Rod Carew. I remember my mom and I used to take a bus to get to Met Stadium in Bloomington. And that was back when you paid one price. We'd always wait till there was a doubleheader so that we get two games for the price of one. And I remember he was chasing 400 one year, and he went 7 for 8. And I was just on fire as a little kid. I was one of those baseball nerds that would check the box scores every day and know exactly what his average was day by day. And the year he stole home 7 times in one year. And then I was just so distraught when he left and went to the Angels, but that's because Calvin Griffith, the owner, was not a very intelligent man as to what he said. drove him out of the Twin Cities. So
those things are tough on young baseball fans. That's for sure. One of the interesting parts about the book is you mentioned Dave Winfield. You seem to have a knack for running across big athletic names. Turner Gill makes an appearance. Joe Girardi makes an appearance. who's the best athlete you've played with?
Well, I talked about at Wichita State. One of the chapters in that book at Wichita State, I call it Large Men, because I was probably showing up to Wichita. I probably looked a little bit like Robbie Benson in one-on-one. And there was Charlie O'Brien, just a big lug of a man, and Russ Moorman. And when you said who's the best athlete, I always mentioned Russ Moorman because he was 6'5" and could do the splits. He was the most flexible person I'd ever seen in my life. And if he got his arms extended, he could hit the ball out at any part of the park. He went to junior college, actually, to Iowa Western as a basketball player. He played in one of the most famous Missouri high school basketball games against Steve Stepanovich as a 6'5" center playing against a 6'11" guy. And as a triple overtime game, he played for William Chrisman. And at any rate, I'm dear friends with Russ to this day, so I always put his name in that category. But, I played with a guy named Kevin Penner, who, when I first saw him run, he was one of those guys that you think is loafing because he's not running hard. And then you look at his strides and he's covering about 5 strides, or 5 of your strides with 1 of his. He had this long loping stride. I think for 2 years, he never had an error in left field. He kind of tragically got hit in the face with a pitch in the 82 World Series. And that's how I actually got into the World Series to replace him. But he came back the following year, wore a face mask, hit 407, and was a first team All-American, and never played professional baseball, which is truly amazing to me because he was one of those kids that would pick up a football and punt it 40 yards and then go shoot par on the golf course and then go bowl, a 240. And it's like, oh, is there anything this man can't do? But those guys always amazed me because I had to kind of fight and scrap for everything, I could do on a field. But so Russ and Kevin Penner are who I put in that category.
How about the best opponent? Who's the best you played against?
Well, I know I mentioned Turner Gill because he hit the hardest ball I ever fielded in my life. But best opponent, at the time, Pete Incaviglia was totally dominant, especially at Oklahoma State. where the wind is always blowing out. It's short fences all around. And, you know, in my senior year, we walked him every time he came to the plate in the regional. And in two games, the guys behind him got some hits. In the game that they didn't, David Haas shut them down and we beat him. And, but he was, yeah, I think he hit 40 some home runs that year. So I would definitely put him in that category. Roger Clemens as a pitcher certainly is someone no right-hander wanted to face at the time. And so I would go with those two. Rafael Palmeiro, there's a lot of players I could put out there, but those would be three of them, I would say.
Yes, the Incavelia home run here in Wichita still gets brought up. I think, you know, every year somebody hits one and bounces on 21st Street, people have to mention the name Pete Incavelia and the home run that he hit out of the stadium. Do you mention that? I think you mentioned that in the book, don't you?
Yes, I definitely mentioned that story. I'll tell you what, that night was really an unbelievable night because we were neck and neck. I would, you know, something like a tie game in the eighth inning, and the rain came pouring down, just a monsoon. And our job as players were to get the tarp out. And as we tried to get the tarp out on the field, a drunken fan came out of the stands with a Coors Light box on his head and stood in the middle of the tarp that we were trying to drag out on the field. And Tim Raley ran across the tarp, and in the Wichita Eagle the next day, they described it as a Hulk Hogan-like drop kick that he hit this guy in the chest with, and then we pushed him off the tarp to get the tarp out. But once that was finished and the rain ended, we got back on the field, and I believe they had bases loaded. And I also believe it was the first pitch from Rich McIntyre that Pete Incavelia launched into the dark, that somewhere far over 21st Street, it landed. And, excuse me, back in those days, we used to play, you know, the non-conference opponents on a Wednesday night, and then we would jump on a sleeper bus for Peoria, Illinois, or Normal, Illinois, or one of our Missouri Valley opponents. And that night, as we were driving through Kansas City at 1 a.m. or something like that, a rock hit the bottom of the bus and rattled around. And for whatever reason, somebody said, "What was that?" And I said, "I think that was Incavelia's ball just landing under the bus." And Rich McIntyre got a good chuckle out of it. He didn't take offense to it. And we all chuckled a little bit and went back to sleep. But those are some of the things I really do enjoy writing about. And I'll tell you, a guy Wichita State fans probably never saw play, but who came to Wichita State with me from Creighton High School was a guy named Joe Padillo. And he lasted 1 year in the program and then left and came up to Kansas City to play at William Jewell. But Joe, I just lost my train of thought. All right, Paul, what was I talking about?
Joe from Minnesota, your friend from high school that came down with you, ended up at right. William Jewell.
Right. At any rate, you know, Joe was a great player, but he is one, the person that I confided in most in writing this book, because he's twice a published author. And as I sent him the first copy of the book, one of the things he came back and said is, "Mark, when you talk about your teammates or game situations or opponents, I can tell that's where you're the most passionate about writing." And so he said, "You need to expand this book And I would say more of that. And so I have a section that I think I called the rest of the sports stories, but it's things like that Oklahoma State game and, you know, things that Brent Kimnitz said on the field and different players that I played against or played with that wowed me in some fashion. And so he was right. I really did enjoy looking back on those moments and those people.
That is good advice. People love those behind the scenes stories, the bus trips, the card games, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, you come to Wichita State in 1982. You've got some great stories about the atmosphere and practice, about Charlie O'Brien, who's, of course, a great catcher with the Shockers and in Major League Baseball. What was it like walking in as a freshman to a program loaded with that much talent in 1982?
Well, I obviously had no clue what I was walking into. I pretty much knew, you know, the guys in Minnesota that I had played against were going to the University of Minnesota. And that's always where I kind of had my head at, that I was going to be a Golden Gopher, follow after Paul Molitor and go to the College World Series. Well, they told me they weren't so interested in me, thought I needed to go to a JUCO and couldn't play at this level. So I end up at Wichita State after Gene contacts me in July, you know, a month before the school year is ready to begin. And I remember walking out onto that field and seeing Charlie O'Brien and Russ Moorman. And I don't know them from Adam, and I've never been to Wichita, Kansas, and I'm scared to death. And I take my first round of batting practice, and Charlie O'Brien, I get done. He takes his mask off and he goes, "You know, I don't want to bring you down, man, but we seriously have seven pitchers with better swings than that." And I just was like, wow, do I start driving back to Minnesota now or do I wait till tonight? But I quickly noticed that he was doing the same banter to every hitter that took around batting practice or some kind of jab at them. He was a talker behind the plate, but he had something that I didn't learn till probably early in my sophomore year that I would call internal swagger. He had complete confidence in his game and nobody intimidated him. And that is something you have to overcome. If you have fear in baseball, you're really up against it. And so while I talk about Charlie, you know, giving me some grief, Charlie was someone that absolutely helped me get to where I was in that program.
So there will be a lot of people listening to this that you know, weren't around back then. Let me run through some names just to give people an idea about what was going on in the program. Don Heinkel, a great pitcher. You mentioned Russ Moorman. You mentioned O'Brien. Brian Elkers, another great pitcher. Phil Stevenson, you know, college baseball Hall of Famer. Jim Thomas, of course, went on to be a Shocker assistant coach for many years. Lauren Hibbs is back with the program. Eric Sonberg, another great pitcher. So you had just, you know, high draft picks, future big leaguers, college baseball Hall of Famers in that group. Just an amazing collection of talent. And I think it's interesting from the standpoint, you know, those were the days when Shocker baseball was very young. The crowds were not very big. They probably picked up some fans as they went to Omaha. Describe being around Gene Stevenson at that point in his career. I got to know him later, a lot of energy then. I would imagine as a younger man, he was just an interesting every day being coached by him.
I would say that is true. I think Gene, because he started that program with basically a bag of baseballs and some kind of field, but that's about it. From the get-go, in the early days, it was an us-against-the-world mentality. And but I will tell you Gene Stevenson stories. The first two, first of all, that fall, inter-squad games, I am hitting off of Don Heinkel, the winningest pitcher in college baseball history. Brian Elkers, who was picked fourth in that draft, 1982, one ahead of Dwight Gooden. And Eric Sonberg, who was picked in the middle of the first round the following year for the Dodgers, a couple of picks ahead of Roger Clemens. And those are the guys I'm hitting against in inter-squad games. And so that is an amazing thing. But we get into the season, and I will say this. Gene basically told me, Mark, you're going to be the 10th man. If somebody is hurt, we'll get you on the field. If everybody's healthy, you're not going to play. While that's not the news you want to hear, that is the communication you definitely want as a player. You want to know your role. But at any rate, the first game I ever play in, we get beat 18-0 at Arizona State. And the following weekend, we go down to Texas, and in a doubleheader, we get shut out back-to-back games by Roger Clemens and Calvin Schiraldi. And Gene had a team meeting after those games and called us, I can't use the full term, but called us gutless, challenged our manhood. And as I think back, your first reaction is, damn, those guys were pretty good to hit against. It was just a challenging day. But his point is, we are not going to be intimidated by anybody anywhere. And we were 4-6 at that point in that season. And he stuck with us. We went 69-8. The rest of that season, won 73 games, the most wins in college baseball, Division I history in one season. And that should be a permanent record since they don't let you play more than 56 games now. But one of the things, one of the stories I talk in there, Gene at that time, and I heard he mellowed, over the years, but he was pretty brand new to being a head coach. And one of the things that was a challenge for someone like me, who is, maybe harder on himself than any coach could ever be, was if you get, 3 hits out of 10 or 4 hits out of 10, you're a great hitter. But if you are talked to every time you make an out, it's tough to forget those 6 outs and get those 4 hits. And Charlie O'Brien pulled me aside very early on and said, Mark, I know you're a competitor. He said, you see that man over there? And he pointed to Gene. He said, if you want to survive in this program, let what he says in this ear go out the other ear. And I took that with a grain of salt, because Gene Stevenson is, first of all, in my opinion, the greatest college baseball coach ever for what he built in that program. But Charlie's point was, you got to free your mind. You can't let him, get in your mind at that time. And for someone who's hard on himself, it is sometimes an overload to have a coach that is. And I heard everything about Gene not doing this and mellowing over the years. But at that time, he was very hands-on and very, in your brain a little bit. And so it was a challenge for some of us to deal with that. But on the flip side, Gene also lost his father at an early age. He talked to me about that a lot. We had a relationship. He, you know, when I ended my career there, you know, he pulled me aside after our final game at Oklahoma State. We finished, you know, one game from the College World Series. And he just said, "Mark, you have been a bulldog in this program." And that, I don't know, it almost brings tears to my eyes right now, because you so want your coach to respect you. And for him to say that about me, well, I get emotional thinking about it. I love the man. I really do. Because I, you know, the other thing I do, Paul, in that book is I talk about father figures, because when you don't have a father, you have to have people step up and play that role. And Gene was absolutely a big part of my life in that fashion.
He may have mellowed some. I started covering Wichita State baseball in 2005, and I always thought that was one of the things, you know, that he did really well, was he would see a player and he would expect so much out of them, maybe more than they expected, maybe more than I expected. And, you know, I thought that way of pushing people you know, was really a key to his success. And that sounds like exactly what you're saying. You started the College World Series game, the title game at Rosenblatt Stadium. Is that one of those feelings you just hang on to for the rest of your life?
You know, when I talk about that experience, I don't think I had played in a game. I certainly didn't play in the regional or in the Missouri Valley tournament. So I don't think I had actually played in a game for at least 3 or 4 weeks. And in the semifinal, Kevin Penner gets hit in the eye with a pitch and is, you know, carted off the field. And I am thrust into the game. And the kids I coach, I've always told this story. I was so afraid of getting picked off at that moment that I probably had around a 2-foot lead, and he threw over and I darn near injured the first baseman's knees. And I you know, landed on the base with my midsection. At any rate, I ended up, you know, scoring a run shortly after that. Russ Moorman hit a long home run and we stormed back in that game and beat Calvin Schiraldi, who at that time a lot of people thought was better than Roger Clemens. Well, that puts us in the national final game against the University of Miami, and I'm the starting left fielder. And it was the second year ESPN had ever done the College World Series. And so I'm on national TV in front of 19,000 fans. And a year earlier, I'm playing high school baseball in the frigid cold in Minnesota. And it was one of those surreal moments that you just are like, how the heck did this just happen to me? And I just was, you know, a lot of things, when you're a thinking man, a lot of things go through your head. But one of the big things is just, you know, do your best, but don't screw this up for the seniors. That this is their moment. And so I, you know, I think I played fairly solidly. I was a little bit overwhelmed at the plate. Miami had a senior pitcher but in the field, I actually set, if you look in the Wichita State records for outfield assists in an NCAA tournament game, I had 2. And I actually had them in the same inning, which is really bizarre that an outfielder would have 2 outfield assists. But it just happened. And I think back to my high school coach, Dennis Denning, who had a saying. One was dare to be great. And the other he always told me was, "Mark, there are going to be days that you are overwhelmed by a pitcher, but do something to help us win. You know, make a play, you know, do some good base running. There are so many ways that you can contribute in some way." So I remember the second guy we threw out at home plate that inning was the final out of the inning, and I came running in, and Charlie was there to greet me to let me know that throw was a little bit on the first base side, and he made a great play to catch it and tag the guy out. And it was so Charlie O'Brien, that jacking with you in the national final game. And I love the man, because he was so relaxed at all times and so confident. And it's probably why he had a 15-year major league career. So
the Shockers played in regionals in Stillwater in 83 and 85. And that was, kind of the early days of that big rivalry. Those games, I guess, set the stage for 88 and 89. Describe the rivalry with Oklahoma State in those days.
Well, it was a dogfight every time. I can tell you that, you know, we emptied the benches, not time and time again, but several times. I remember a game in Stillwater where Mark Nordyke went out of his out of the baseline to take out their second baseman on a double play, and Gene came out and argued because they called it an automatic double play. Well, Gary Ward actually came out next to the umpire and Gene and said that was a horse bleep play by a horse bleep player on a horse bleep play. The benches emptied after they just about came to blows themselves. But my best memories of playing for Wichita State are playing games against them in Stillwater. One of the harshest memories I have, in harshest and best, but my sophomore year, 1983, we were ranked in the top five most of the year, and kind of late in the year, we had some academic casualties and some injuries and things like that. So after we played in the Missouri Valley Tournament, I had hit my first collegiate home run in Missouri Valley Tournament against Southern Illinois. And that night, I found out my brother had committed suicide in Minnesota. And so I didn't tell Gene, I didn't tell anybody on the team except for Tim Gaskell. And I talked to my mom, and we decided I should go play the regional and then come home afterwards instead of going up there for the funeral. And I remember playing that regional for some reason with a free mind. I realized that baseball and a baseball game had very little meaning in the whole scope of life. And I played. And I played the best baseball game I ever played against Arkansas in that regional, made a couple diving plays at third base and had a great game offensively. I hit another home run in that regional, and I made the all tournament team, and nobody else on our team did. And I really believe that was, you know, the Arkansas coach came up to me after the game and said, "Mark, my bunkmate in the Marines was your high school basketball coach. And he told me I needed to recruit you. And after the day, I sure wish I had, because you just about, you know, beat us single-handedly today." And I said, "Well, I didn't beat you single-handedly, but thank you for mentioning it." But so that was crazy. And then in 85, you know, we went down there, and that's when we were walking Pete Incaviglia every time. And We beat him once and lost to him twice and finished one game from going to the College World Series. And but I think that stadium was a great hitter's park, and I always had really good success down there. And I think seven of us made the all-regional team that year. And at any rate, Oklahoma State, Wichita State in those days was – just absolutely a joy to play in those games. Gary Ward used to say publicly he didn't like to play against Wichita State because they don't get intimidated. They battle us, you know, tooth and nail every pitch, every inning. So,
yeah, just a great rivalry, really defined baseball in this part of the country for, you know, going on 15 years or so. It was really, really a fun thing to be a part of, I'm sure.
Right.
You've been a big supporter of League 42 here in Wichita. The baseball gets young kids involved in baseball. Bob Lutz is a former Eagle columnist and current radio guy. Wichita State alum has that up and running. What do you like about League 42? Why are you involved?
Paul, it's because when I think back in my youth, I have coached at all kinds of different levels since I got done playing. And I coached at the highest level of travel and showcase baseball, you know, for Mackensites up here in Kansas City. And I just thought what Bob had going and what Kansas City Urban Youth Academy up here in Kansas City has going is something that's needed. There are a lot of kids with a lot of talent that don't have the money to have private lessons and go to showcases all over the country every weekend. And if baseball is going to survive long term, they have to get kids from the inner city, you know, building a passion for the game, and hopefully they can do that. But as soon as Bob asked me to try to get the Wichita State alumni involved, at that time Coach Butler had done away with our alumni tournament, and I rejuvenated that alumni tournament and made it into the League 42 annual tournament and gave the money to League 42. And this is our sixth year. We'll have it this Friday, actually. And I just couldn't be, you know, prouder of what Bob has going. He had a goal of getting 150 kids playing. He's got 600 kids in that program now. He's got an after-school center where they're helping kids with a STEM education. He does great, great work, and I believe in it wholeheartedly. And that's why I'll always support it. And the coaching I do nowadays is at the Kansas City Urban Youth Baseball Academy that was started by the Royals. And it's the same thing. But they even work with kids all the way through high school, and they're starting to see kids get, you know, chances at, you know, major colleges and small colleges and getting a real chance to go on with their baseball careers. And that's something I'd like to see Bob expand to is keep, I think he ends at age 14. You know, if he can keep following some of those kids, you know, I was really pleased to see the last College World Series final that happened, Michigan and Vanderbilt. Both of those coaches said they are starting to look to the inner city for athletes where they can find somebody, you know, with a limited amount of scholarships, whatever it is, 11.7, they really need to find different avenues to find players. And both of them have kind of said it was like following sheep to go to this, you know, these showcases every weekend. And they started recruiting out of the inner city. And if you looked at Michigan's lineup, they had, you know, four kids from the inner city that they had found who were just wonderful, great athletes. And it really, I think, opened people's eyes that the final two teams standing had started to recruit differently than everybody else. And hopefully the rest of college baseball and pro baseball starts taking a look. So
poetry is a big part of the book. Why did you start writing poetry?
You know, I don't really know how I got started writing it. But I assume it's another it's another way of, you know, getting my mind off reality. But most of my poems have been for a certain event or some kind of somebody needs to have an uplift in their life because they're having surgery or going through a sickness or I've written them about the Chiefs and the Royals. I've written them for a lot of birthdays for my kids. It's just a way for me to communicate in my own unique way, both for my son's engagement party or the night before his wedding, and for my daughter's wedding speech, I did some poems. And once I started doing it, I just have kind of enjoyed the challenge, but mostly to make people laugh and to, you know, uplift them in their life.
Do you have a favorite that you've written?
I think probably my favorite is the one that I wrote for my daughter, for her wedding. The daddy-daughter speech is kind of the mecca of all speeches for a dad. And, I grew up in such a sports man culture that when I had my daughter, it just absolutely has been a joy that I cannot even imagine having. She's got the greatest heart in the world. She's a English teacher at Turner High School up here in Kansas City. She's just a wonderful woman. And all her life, people kind of questioned her toughness. And when she got an academic scholarship to go to University of Nebraska, and she, after two or three visits, accepted it. Everybody thought she'd go to K-State and KU or K-State and be home for, you know, doing her laundry on the weekends. And she went to Nebraska. She had never driven on a freeway before. She went up there. We did some driving and she flourished. She just keeps going above and beyond anyone's expectations. And it was very, very heartfelt and meaningful to do the speech at her wedding. So that poem probably has the most meaning to me.
That is a big moment. Mark Grogan's book is I Owe It All to Baseball. Mark, tell people how they can get a copy of your book.
All they can go to Amazon.com or Kindle and purchase my book. I will also be bringing 42 books to the League 42 golf tournament this Friday. I'd be happy to sign them, but because it's a fundraiser, I'm going to try to average $42 per book at that golf tournament and donate the proceeds to League 42. And I'm going to do the following weekend is the Wichita State Baseball Alumni Weekend. And since this is the 35th anniversary of my senior year, I'm going to bring 35 copies to that and try to get $50 a copy and give the money to Wichita State Baseball.
And the League 42 golf tournament, where is that?
It's this Friday. We tee off at noon at Sand Creek Station in Newton. And people could sign up still if they wanted to get involved somehow. Sand Creek Station Golf Club, golfclub.com/League42.
Thank you for listening to the Roundhouse Podcast, courtesy of Wichita State University Strategic Communications. We appreciate your time. We encourage you to rate, review, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, such as on iTunes or Google Play. You can find more Roundhouse content at GoShockers.com. Thank you for listening.
And they let him pass it up court, and then it gets picked off. A long three by Pangos. No good. 1 second. It's over. It is over, and Wichita State has beaten the number one team in the nation to go to the Sweet 16. Go crazy, Wichita. I know you are.